This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Millie wird bei uns einziehen.
Hallo?
Basierend auf dem weltweiten Bestseller.
Soll ich Ihnen alles zeigen? Sie sollen sich hier sicher fühlen. Das tue ich.
Mit Sydney Sweeney.
Sie sind meine Rettung. Was würde ich nur ohne Sie tun?
Und Amanda Seyfried. The Housemaid, wenn sie wüsste. Ab 15. Januar im Kino.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the think spot in the metaverse, where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, COVID infections in Britain have been soaring again. How worried should we be this time around? Has the nature of the virus changed? And how much of a threat does it pose to the NHS? Right now, according to the Organisation of National Statistics, 4% of the population have got COVID. After 2.5 years of the pandemic last month, your multi-jab presenter got it too. I'm okay, thank you. Now, I don't know what variant I had, but it's likely that it was one of the new Omicron sub-variants, about which there's been a fair bit of concern. But how worried should we be this time? Has the virus really mutated in an alarming way? And how much of a threat does coronavirus still pose to the NHS? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with the latest stats. We asked James Gallagher, the BBC's health and science correspondent, to be our talking COVID dashboard.
If you picture what's happening with COVID in the United Kingdom as like a roller coaster, say the big one in Blackpool, you're not going to be too far off. So we reached heights we'd never seen before around the end of March, when 5 million people in the UK were estimated to be testing positive for COVID. And then that plummeted sharply down to about 1 million by the end of May. But since then, we've been swinging back up again quite steeply. So around 2.7 million, or 1 in 25 of us, has the virus in our bodies now. There are some subtle signs that it might be peaking again, but we'll only know that for sure once we're past the peak and we can look back and know. The amount of COVID isn't evenly spread across the whole of the United Kingdom. So Scotland has the highest infection rates, where 1 in 17 people would test positive for the virus. England has the lowest, with 1 in 25. Wales and Northern Ireland are somewhere in between. But that doesn't really mean that Scotland's doing badly and England's doing really well, because Scotland looks like it's more likely to be peaking than other parts of the UK. It's just ahead of the curve, really, when it comes to the number of people being infected. And again, it's not really just a UK issue either. You see a similar pattern emerging in different parts of Europe. So Italy, Germany, France all have their cases coming up. Portugal looks like it's seen off this wave and is now bringing its cases back down. Now, it will come as no surprise that as the number of people catching coronavirus has increased, so too has the number of people ending up in hospital. However, even there are subtle hints that we may be approaching the peak across the UK in terms of the number of people being admitted to hospital. It's really important to be careful with these figures, though, because they include people who are in hospital because COVID has made them so sick they need treatment, but also people who have other conditions that get admitted to hospital, they get tested while they're there, and it turns out that they had COVID. A really useful figure to look at is what's happening in intensive care to the people that need mechanical ventilation to keep them alive. And if you look in England, about 274 people are on mechanical ventilation. That is higher than it was in June when it was around 130, but it is phenomenally lower than in January 2021, when more than 3,500 people needed ventilation. So despite these huge surges in the number of people being infected, we're not seeing the same surge in the number of people getting severely ill. You can think of what's happened in the UK this year with COVID as like three separate waves. We had a wave of Omicron, so that new variant. Then we had a new flavour of Omicron, one called BA2. And now we've got BAs 4 and 5 causing the most recent wave. Now, while they have proven their ability to get round some of our immunity and spread easily, they've never shown that they're more serious and causing more deadly disease. Wherever you're listening to this from in the UK, there's been one core strategy that's been trying to get our lives back to normal, back to what it was like before the pandemic, and that is vaccination. And huge numbers of people have been vaccinated. 70% of people aged over 12 have not only had their first dose, their second dose, but at least one booster dose as well. However, there are 3 million people who, for a huge number of different reasons, have still not had a single dose of a COVID vaccine.
James Gallagher. Now, one thing we've learned during the pandemic is that public attitudes and public behaviour are critical. So what is the state of public opinion on COVID? Next into the briefing room is Gideon Skinner, Head of Politics Research in Public Affairs at the pollsters Ipsos. Gideon Skinner, you've just published your latest pandemic survey. What does the new data tell us? Are people still very worried about COVID?
So I think it shows that there is latent concern out there about COVID. Just over half are worried about the risk to themselves and slightly more about the risk to the country. But both of those levels of concern are lower than we've seen during the heights of the pandemic. And actually, if we look at the broader sense of the public's agenda on our Ipsos Issues Index, if we go back to 2020, early 21, then 7 to 8 in 10 were saying that COVID was the most important issue facing the country, which was clearly dominating everything. And even actually, if we go back to just December last year, concern about COVID peaked again. But since then, it's sort of rapidly fallen down the agenda. And for example, it's overtaken most clearly by cost of living. We see concern about cost of living is highest for 40 years in our data.
What can your data tell us about whether people are still following any of the measures we've become so familiar with, like self-testing, staying at home if infected, and just maybe avoiding crowded places such as public transport?
People say at least that they are unlikely to go to a large public event or to visit elderly relatives if they tested positive for COVID-19. But there are still minorities. So around 1 in 3, for example, say they would not self-isolate if they felt well. And sort of around about half say they would still go for a walk outside if they tested positive. Nearly 4 in 10 workers say they would be likely to leave their home. So people are certainly changing their behaviours and not being quite as strict as they were during the height of the pandemic.
Gideon, what does your data tell us about how the public might react to the reintroduction of measures like compulsory masks or other aspects of social distancing?
Clearly, people would not be particularly happy about it. It depends on the exact nature of the restrictions. So, for example, there would be some support for bringing back some previous restrictions. Around about half say they would do that. But if we're getting into, say, a sort of full lockdown, that drops to just 1 in 3, and more people would be opposed to that. So there'd definitely be more resistance to the stricter set of rules.
Now, does your data pick up a concern about the NHS with regard to COVID? Or is the concern that people have about the NHS about the general state of the NHS?
There's still clearly a lot of concern, particularly about waiting lists, which is seen as the biggest concern facing the NHS. And 6 in 10 say they're not confident that an ambulance would come quickly, or they could get seen in A&E quickly, or get a GP appointment when they need one. 3/4 think that waiting times are too long. And there are some signs, certainly in our data, that although people don't think that's only due to the pandemic, there is a large part of that is seen as the impact of the pandemic.
Gideon Skinner. The other critical factor governing pandemic response has always been the state of the NHS. To tell us how COVID is currently impacting the health service is Miriam Deakin, Director of Policy and Strategy at NHS Providers. Miriam Deakin, how many COVID patients are currently occupying beds in NHS England, as far as we know?
Well, the latest figures that we have are that there are about 13,600 beds treating COVID patients at the moment. And actually, we've seen quite a steady increase in hospital admissions due to COVID, really since the beginning of June. Actually, in the last week, we saw an uptick of around 20%. So that will quite quickly and is already putting additional strain on services across the NHS and care.
Now, can we just make sure that we've got the distinctions right? You talked about an increase in 20% in the number of people who require treatment for COVID. That's as distinct from people who come in with other conditions and may have COVID.
That's right, yes. So a 20% uptick in hospital admissions due to COVID are what the figures tell us in the last 7 days.
Right, but not necessarily all those 13,000 are due to COVID. So a fair proportion will be people who've actually just got COVID but have also got something else.
That's right. It can be a mix because people may be in hospital with other conditions and may realise that they have COVID alongside that. But I think the key point here is that we're seeing infection rates in the community rise quite significantly. So as a minimum, at least one in 25 of us, probably more, has COVID out there in the community. And that translates very quickly into hospital admissions and additional pressures on the NHS. It also starts to hit NHS staff, of course, as well. We are seeing higher levels of staff absence across the NHS at the moment. Now, some of that's very directly related to COVID. If staff are unwell themselves, it can also be related to stress and burnout, which are all factors which we've seen increase significantly over the last couple of years. So staff absence coupled with workforce shortages are a real concern for the NHS at the moment.
So although actually compared to some other periods of the pandemic, those numbers are not huge, what you're telling me is it's still causing problems.
That's right. We're not at the level that we faced in January of this year in terms of bed occupancy related to COVID. But nonetheless, we have been seeing significant increases week by week, really since the start of June. And that is putting pressure on a system which is already under considerable strain. So as you know, the NHS is doing all it can to bear down on care backlogs, which are a result of the pandemic that we've just been through. We've got the immediate pressure of the heat wave in this week and into next. And all of that is meaning that people are sometimes waiting for longer than we would want for the care that the NHS is due to provide them.
I don't want to sound like a gloomster here, but what would happen if we got a bad flu season here like they're having currently in Australia?
It's an important question, and the NHS does face quite an uncertain future, I think, over the summer months. There is concern that the flu season may come earlier than it does in previous years, which would simply add more pressure to a system which is under strain already. In that event, we'd be grappling with care backlogs on the back of the pandemic, some quite significant workforce shortages, the potential for different variants of COVID to emerge, and of course, flu, which is another potentially severe respiratory disease. So that really would put the system under considerable pressure. We know that trust leaders are concerned about the summer months, which is the time when you might traditionally hope to make some inroads into those care backlogs and reduce those waiting lists. And that at the moment is not the experience of frontline leaders and their staff, unfortunately. So they are concerned about how the summer will pan out. And then, of course, we'll be quite swiftly into autumn and traditional winter pressures when the NHS is always under a little bit more strain.
So, Miriam, every time that we've introduced significant restrictions, from lockdowns to other restrictions, it's been because we've been worried about the NHS collapsing under the weight of COVID. Can you see such a situation recurring?
I don't think that the prospect of lockdown is on the cards politically or necessarily required at the moment. But I do think that we can expect to see hospitals reintroduce additional restrictions. And we're seeing that already. So they may well expect and ask the public to wear a mask in particular settings. Of course, they'll be very mindful about social distancing themselves and the types of PPE, protective equipment that they need to use. We're certainly seeing that already. And local hospitals have the autonomy to adjust the precautions that they take depending on the levels of infection in their local area. That's very important. We all want to move on from COVID, but unfortunately it is still with us. So we would ask the public to bear with us and to be mindful of those precautionary measures.
Miriam Deakin. Of course, in the end, what really matters is what the virus is doing and is likely to do. Just how tricky are the new COVID variants and how good are the tools we currently have to deal with them? Joining me in the briefing room are two epidemiologists, Megan Cole, who works at the UK Health Security Agency, and Neil Ferguson, head of the MRC Centre for Global Infectious Disease Analysis at Imperial College. Megan Cole, let's talk about BA5, as that seems to be the main driver in the UK at the moment. What's different about it, and how comparatively more effective is it at evading our existing defences?
BA5 has an advantage in that it has an improved ability to evade the immunity that we've acquired previously from infection and vaccination. So it basically means that if you've been vaccinated, you have a slightly higher chance of getting infected. And if you've been infected before, you have a slightly higher chance of being reinfected.
Right. Now, Neil, does this mean that we're about to enter a big new phase of the pandemic, as we did when we shifted between previous major variants, such as Alpha and Delta, and then Delta to Omicron?
That's unlikely, just because Omicron BA5 and BA4 is also circulating in the UK, are slightly different from the previous BA1 and BA2, which caused waves in December and then February, March, but nowhere near as different as, say, Omicron was from Delta. So we expect to see some sort of wave, but there's some preliminary evidence it may even have already peaked in England. So I don't expect to see any sort of overwhelming wave or anything even of the same scale that we had back in November, December.
Okay, Megan, BA5's powers of reinfection, which we've alluded to, seem to be worrying people most at the moment, and actually, frankly, worries me. How exactly does the new variant do that?
There are some mutations in the BA5 variant, which means that when somebody is exposed to it, then the immune system may not recognize it in terms of its antibody response. However, the change in its ability to evade the immune system is not nearly as different as it was when Omicron originally came on the scene after the Delta wave.
Neil Ferguson, there was an awful lot of talk that one way or another you'd move towards herd immunity through vaccination plus infection. And now you have variants of a virus that seem to be able to reinfect. Is that level of reinfection unusual for a virus?
I think it very much depends on the virus, but it's not unusual for coronaviruses. Coronaviruses circulate in the human population all the time. There are certain ones which have been in probably humans for hundreds of years, and they're one of the major causes of the common cold. And what we know about immunity there is that you do get protection from infection, but it probably only lasts a year or two, partly because immunity wanes, the antibody levels in your blood drop over time, but also because the viruses evolve. And so herd immunity isn't an all or nothing thing. It's an indication of a balance between immunity in the population and the transmission of whichever virus you're considering. And we're approaching that state now with SARS-CoV-2, the virus which causes COVID. But that doesn't mean we don't get any infections. We'll just get a lower level of what's called endemic circulation of the virus.
And does that mean, Megan, that people are going to be getting it 3, 4, 5 times during the course of the next few years?
It's really difficult to predict with any certainty how the future is going to pan out. If we look at other respiratory viruses, we do see that immunity does wane over time. We get periodic waves, usually seasonal. And so whilst it depends on quite a lot of different factors, including new variants, new vaccines and treatments, it is likely that we will continue to see new waves in the future. What's really important is that we try to keep the impact as low as possible.
Neil, one of the things that I thought characterized the pre-Omicron variants were that they tended to be lower respiratory, lungs and so on, and the Omicron was upper respiratory, nose and throat. Was that impression of mine right? And if it is right, is that true of BA5?
I mean, your impression is basically right, but it's not an all or nothing thing. There's more of a tendency for Omicron variants to colonize the upper respiratory tract, and they're less likely to cause lower respiratory tract infection, which is probably why Omicron, all Omicron variants, are much less severe than the Delta variants. As to how the different Omicron variants vary themselves, there may be slight variations in severity. It's quite hard to measure with current data, but they are slight. All of them seem to have that remarkable property, which has been good for humanity, of being much less severe than Delta or Alpha.
Now, Megan, some countries are further ahead than us with BA5, notably, I gather, South Africa and Portugal, I think. What's the evidence from those countries tell us?
What we've seen in Portugal and South Africa is that when they had BA4 or 5 waves, they saw hospitalizations and deaths peaking at or below the levels that they saw previously with their Omicron wave over the winter. Of course, it's very difficult to predict how that will translate to the UK, but it's really reassuring that we're not seeing a significant change in severity. We have two nice studies from South Africa that compared the risk of hospitalization during their BA4-5 wave compared to their BA1 Omicron wave last winter, and they saw no excess risk in terms of the severe disease. So that's reassuring, but we are monitoring that really closely here in the UK to see what the impact will be here.
Neil, are there any other variants out there that might give us pause?
In terms of other variants popping up, they're popping up all the time. It's hit the headlines in some areas of the world that there's a variant called BA2.75, which has popped up in India, which has cause for a little concern, or at least to be monitored, just because of the number of mutations it has in that critical spike protein, which is the protein primarily recognized by the immune system. So I think it's important that we maintain genomic surveillance to monitor these trends over time. But I'm not overly concerned. We would expect to see continuous evolution of this virus.
Megan, are we learning an awful lot more as a consequence of our surveilling the progress of COVID?
So the surveillance systems that were set up at the beginning of the pandemic gave us an enormous amount of information, as you say, about helping us to characterize the virus, understand the spread and the epidemiology. It's really important to note that we have a really strong global genomic surveillance system that is constantly monitoring mutations in the virus. So at the moment, at the top of our list of things that we're looking for is new variants. And in fact, Britain has one of the best genomics programs in the world, and we're able to, I think, see quite early on if there's any signals of any major changes that we can look into to try and understand what's causing those.
Neil Ferguson, let's now shift to the question of what we're going to do about all this. Now, sticking to BA5, how good would you say our current vaccines are against this variant in terms of protecting us from infection and in terms of limiting the seriousness once we are infected?
The good news is that all the vaccines in use in the UK, particularly if you've had a booster, provide a high level of protection against all variants, including Omicron, including BA5, we think, against hospitalisation and certainly against death. And that immunity is boosted still further by the fact that nearly everybody in the UK has been infected with COVID at this point, which tops up the immunity. Protection against infection, though, is a different story. The vaccines still in use in the UK and the rest of the world were designed to tackle the original Chinese Wuhan strain of SARS-CoV-2. And the virus has evolved a lot since then. So those vaccines, unfortunately, provide very little protection against being infected with the virus. They just protect you against the severe consequences of disease. The good news is that the vaccine manufacturers have updated their vaccines now, and those updated vaccines targeting the Omicron variant are now in testing, and we should get results through in the next few months. If those results look positive, then it's highly likely that countries, including the UK, will at some point in the next 6 months switch over to using the updated vaccines.
Neil, given all you've just said about the variants and the vaccines, how is the modelling on the pandemic looking as we head into the autumn and winter?
We've updated our modelling recently, looking at scenarios for potential new variants going forward in the next year and how we best use vaccine. And the good news is, so long as new variants stay at Omicron levels of severity, we don't see any particular risk of overwhelming waves of hospitalizations and deaths. So we won't need to go back to social distancing measures. The question is, how can we best use vaccines going forward to minimize the obvious burden of disease we're still going to get? And that would suggest that having vaccines which are slightly more adapted to the current variant would help. But more than anything, it's important to top up the immunity of those who are most vulnerable to severe outcomes. And so that means giving additional boosters to the elderly, to people in extremely clinically vulnerable groups, just as the UK has done actually in the first few months of this year with the second booster going out to over 75s. Looking further into the future, it's an interesting question, and no country has determined its policy yet on how it's going to transition from this emergency phase of the pandemic, where we did something unprecedented, vaccinated the entire population of the country in 1 year, evolve that into a sustainable control strategy against COVID, this new virus. And I think a lot of work still remains to be done to work out, you know, are we going to need, just as we do for flu, to have annual jabs going to people over a certain age? Can we top up immunity every 2 years?
Neil, before I put that point to Megan, can I take it from what you're saying that you don't think that it would be either necessary or particularly effective to reintroduce some restrictions such as, say, compulsory mask wearing?
At the end of the day, these are policy decisions, because there is a balancing between what benefit they might give at reducing transmission versus the costs and the restrictions on freedom such measures require. But taking the threshold for the introduction of such measures being the potential for the NHS to be overwhelmed, I don't think it's going to be necessary to introduce such measures. With one very important caveat to that, and that is that we don't get a completely left field variant, which somehow jumps in severity to something more like we had with Delta last year. But if the variants stay at the current level of severity, given all the immunity we have in the population around the world, with the exception of China, I think we're in actually quite a good place going forward.
Megan, can I ask if you broadly agree with both the prospectus that Neil's laid out there and what that says about further restrictions?
So in terms of our ability to track and predict what the virus is going to do, I agree with what Neil says. In the absence of any new variant coming out that's completely unique and has very unusual characteristics, we should be able to relatively confidently predict and prepare for future waves. I think in terms of how the virus mutates in the future, what we do know and what we can expect is that there will be new variants, but as long as they stay at the same or similar level to what we're seeing now in terms of its severity, that I think we will be able to cope quite effectively with those.
So Megan, just to be clear, what you're saying is we're stuck with the virus in one form or another. It can't be killed off. And not only that, but don't think this is a kind of winter autumn thing. This is an all year round thing.
That's right. At the moment, this is clearly not a winter seasonal virus. You know, we've had this wave now in the summer. We had a wave last summer. It's very difficult to predict how this is going to bed in the long run. But yes, we can expect that COVID will be with us for a while. So I think we need to be looking at our mitigation measures, and that includes vaccines as our strongest form of protection. Also adapting therapeutic treatments that we have in the pipeline and trying to, again, mitigate the impact of the virus on our most vulnerable communities and in terms of healthcare pressures and other pressures in the system.
Megan Call there with Neil Ferguson. And my conclusion is that as long as we don't get that left field severe variant, we appear to have the tools to do the job, which is just as well, because as we discovered in the briefing room last month, the NHS is barely coping with its other demands. My thanks to James Gallagher, Megan Call, Neil Ferguson, Gideon Skinner and Miriam Deakin. The briefing room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Kirstine Knight and Simon Watts. The editor was Richard Varden. The programme was mixed by Rod Farker. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, and if you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds.
J. Edgar Hoover created and ran the FBI for almost 50 years.
Nobody should have that powerful position for that length of time.
His job was to enforce the law, but he did not always follow it.
Hoover was basically creating a secret police.
Find out what his FBI looked like.
This is like Stasi.
And hear firsthand from the group who had an astonishing plan to expose him.
We became convinced that the FBI was illegal.
From BBC Radio 4, The People versus J. Edgar Hoover, with me, Emily Maitlis. Listen first on BBC Sounds.